Unpack your knives and stay. Yes, stay. Welcome to the Top Chef Wrap Up Judges Roundup Table. I think that's what it is. I don't know. We're a couple weeks in. I still haven't got the hang of that one yet. We have a full house here. You know, none of us have anything better to do right now. So we've got 7 people on the podcast, including me, Haley Strong. I am here. More importantly, we're joined for the first time since the draft by Mike Bloom. Mike Bloom, thank you for gracing us with your presence.
Oh my God.
What are you, a top 10 finisher in Sequester Mini?
No, barely. Not even. I got triple
tricks.
Sorry. Yeah, spoiler. I'm sorry. Spoilers for the internet show that happened last night.
Present company can understand what it's like to be twist screwed in an especially in an online reality show. But I'm happy to be here. Really, the human version of peanut butter and jelly fried rice. Just a strange, strange idea, but you want a taste of me no matter what.
Oh my gosh. Mike,
wow, that was very arrogant. That was very arrogant.
Can we ban you from the show?
Yeah. Nope. I've put down roots. I'm here now.
We also have Antonio Mazzaro. What's up, Antonio?
Why did you do me next after Mike?
I don't know.
You said it was the Top Chef Roundup Table. We are not sponsored by Monsanto. They are evil, horrible people. I want to make that clear from the jump. Roundup sucks. It causes bladder cancer, stuff like that. I'm not going to get sued for
Drag them, Tonio.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks. I'm glad to be here following Mike. Mike made a joke right before we started that I still can't get out of my head.
Yeah, I like how you followed up my thing of like, wow, that's a weird image of Mike being peanut butter jelly and fried rice. But let me use my platform to just talk about Monsanto for a second.
Haley, you said Roundup, so I got triggered.
Round down? The round down table? Like that makes
sense. How about Round Howard? I'm
Josh,
here.
This isn't for you. This is not your introduction.
Follow Kurt. Round Howard.
What's up, Kurt? How are you doing, Kurt? What's up, Kurt? Welcome, Kurt.
Hi. I got nothing now. I'm just gonna sit back and wait for the show to start at this point. I'm good. It's early here on the left coast and sun hasn't come out yet. Sorry for those of you who have snow.
And of course, we're joined by my favorite person in the roundup. I'm sorry, Antonio. Okay. Emily Fox. Emily, what's up?
I'm, just here for the witty banter per usual. And I brought my sourdough with me that I'm going to be slowly mixing as we go along, just because.
I wonder how that's going to sound.
Oh, I was going to say this. Like, this is purely euphemistic for this being an audio only podcast.
I'm nervous because like I'm both worried about how that's going to sound in terms of like what do people think that means, but also what will it sound like as we're kneading sourdough on a microphone?
It's firming up, and it's just a quick.
I'm sure it's firming up.
Yeah. It is.
All right, we'll mute ourselves once the kneading begins.
No. You hold it up to the microphone and you knead it. We need ASMR and RHAP, to be quite honest.
I don't know if we haven't capitalized on.
Oh, RHASMR.
And last but certainly not least, we are so excited to be joined by a special guest today. Jim Smith. What's up, Jim?
Yeah. Thank you all for the ovation. It is wonderful to be back on the podcast with you guys. I miss you all very much. I will have to say that opening a restaurant has been hectic for me, and especially now in these times, but I haven't been able to do some of the things that I love, like Live Tweet Survivor or Top Chef lately, mostly just because I've been in the kitchen cooking. But just to let y'all know, I haven't forgotten about you all out there. I will say, Haley, that the Bachelor has gotten a short-term X off of my viewing.
I won't take offense to that.
But I'm here and doing well and running a restaurant by myself and my wife. We're doing only curbside pickup and, you know, we have masks and gloves and all those kind of things. Lots of bottles of Lysol everywhere, trying to make sure it doesn't get sprayed in the food and sending it out the door.
Yeah. How are you holding up, Jim?
You know, I'm okay. It's really difficult. Like it's like I say, you know, since the restaurant that we own, it's, you know, we're not paying a bunch of salaries. I'm doing a lot of the work anyway. And so we're probably in better shape than a lot of other restaurants. But I mean, that being said, you know, even though we're serving our community, it's not really the most sustainable format as of now. You know, I mean, we don't live in New York, so rent's not as astronomical, you know, so there being in Alabama has its benefits that in that regard. But, you know, like every restaurant, you know, we are struggling mightily. And, you know, seriously, having a restaurant, I know you can't really, I'm in the restaurant now. We have a big restaurant, and it's almost like running a food truck. You know, there are two people in the kitchen, but instead there's this massive 3,000 square foot building that, you know, I have a power bill to do on, you know,
Optimus Prime.
Yeah. But I, you know, I'm doing well. I'm staying optimistic. I am hopeful that, you know, Alabama finally issued the, you know, the stay at home order, which is a big move, an important move. I know that the governor had been getting lots of beef on late night TV and all over the internet. And so, but at the same time, even though being at work doesn't feel like the safest place to be, I also feel like I don't really have an option. You know, I would like to say this is probably at the beginning and at the end too. And I know that all you Top Chef fans out there have probably been paying attention to Tom and Padma talking about the James Beard Foundation. The James Beard Foundation does so much, and I have, you know, at least weekly, if not biweekly, conference calls with the James Beard Foundation, trying to figure out how to get money, how to apply for these loans, how to apply for grants. And, you know, you can donate money directly to the James Beard Foundation, which in turn goes directly to restaurants. I know that we applied for the James Beard grant maybe 15 minutes after it was posted. That was last week. And they had such an overwhelming response for, you know, $15,000 worth of grant money is what they're offering to anybody who applies. It's just a first come, first serve basis. But they were out, you know, they had their systems were maxed and they were out within the first hour. And so, I mean, even though we applied for that grant money, I don't know if we'll get it or not. You know, any little bit helps. But, you know, any little bit that you can donate to the James Beard Foundation goes to help independent restaurants like a guy like me who's cooking all the food and washing all the dishes and taking all the orders and running all the food out the door to people. It's a huge help. I didn't mean to start off on such a serious note.
That's amazing. It's really wonderful to get your perspective as a restaurant owner, because we've been talking about it for weeks now. And, you know, I work in restaurants in a different capacity. Emily has hospitality experience. She's kind of felt the force of all of this. It's great to hear you speak so eloquently about tangible things that people can be doing to support this really, really important sector of the economy that is just at a standstill right now. And it may not recover, and we have to do anything we can to make sure it does. So you mentioning that is fantastic, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah.
You know, I will say too that we had a Zoom meeting with all the Top Chef Charleston people not too long. It was really more of a Zoom happy hour, but I will say that the only people who have open restaurants currently is Brooke, who is doing curbside delivery, Sylvia, who is toughing it out in Brooklyn, and myself. And I think that everybody else from the season is not operating their business currently. And I guarantee that every single chef who's on this season of Top Chef All Stars is going through the same things.
Yeah, it's tough.
I would say that just to kind of reinforce the James Beard donations, I've worked with some of those people pretty closely. I covered someone's maternity leave on the media team this past fall. So I know a lot of the people that are behind sort of computers trying to make this work for everybody. And they're an excellent organization. I couldn't
Good
be
people.
Yeah, more thrilled that they, of course, with all of their years of experience and sort of understanding of the food world to the extent that they are, being there sort of on the front lines trying to help everybody who is really going through a rough time. So yeah, I think hashtag good food for good. Let's see what we can get going with all of this. I think we'll definitely post a link so that we can make sure people know where to donate.
For sure. And Jim, before we like start diving into the episode proper, can you just give us an update on like your restaurant, where you are, where people can find you, anything, if anyone wants to help you out directly, whatever they can do?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my restaurant is called The Hummingbird Way. We are located in Mobile, Alabama. We opened on January 7th. So there's not like there's massive amounts of reserves in my coffers. You know, we are a brand new restaurant. We've just opened. We were killing it. We were doing really well until everything shut down. And also because we're such a new restaurant, I'm not set up. You know, I have a splash page for my website, which has been up for a month and it's already out of date. But it's, you know, if you want to call the restaurant directly and buy a gift certificate, I'd love to sell y'all one. You know, but really, other than that, you know, that's where I am.
Yeah.
The social media, my social media is probably taking a back seat to the restaurant social media, which is just at the Hummingbird Way. It's very easy to find. You can find cool pictures of the restaurant and the food that we're doing. And, you know, right now we're just serving, literally tonight, I'll be serving one dish, one carry out option that has four courses and that's it. You know, we've tried a few different things over the past couple of weeks, but it's a lot to keep up with. And, you know, you can't really, I would love to be able to buy more food, but I can't really buy like a whole ribeye because I'm going to have 7 or 8 leftover pieces. And, you know, I can't buy live crawfish, which are in season now, because I don't want to have a bunch of live crawfish in the restaurant. So really it's about being smart with what we purchase and buying things, you know, like, we get amazing frozen shrimp from Alabama. They freeze them on the boat. Really, it's hard. Any shrimp in America you eat is going to be frozen on a boat almost, unless you know somebody to get it from off the docks. And so we serve super high quality stuff, but it's things that have to be conservable and things that I can save. And so that's where we are.
A meat fiesta the other night. I'm on your Instagram.
I want to know what's the menu for tonight.
A couple nights ago, you had choice of two meats. You get your shrimp, your grouper, your quail, your leg of lamb. Some pork chop with Szechuan aioli. Sounds delightful, Jim.
Yeah, I love the food that we've been making here. We've been doing really cool stuff. But in all seriousness, all of that meat extravaganza that's been going on, it's been me working through the coolers to make sure that we don't lose anything and things that can be frozen. And it's sad for a chef to say that, you know, I'm ordering things that can be frozen and, you know, vegetables that I know will last a week at a time, or
a lot of like pantry stocking stuff now. There's a lot of restaurants in where Emily and I live in Brooklyn. Tomorrow we're going to visit one of our favorite local spots that has reshifted from rather than doing like standard takeout or delivery of like their standard fare, they are actually like breaking down what they typically cook, some of their signature dishes, into components. So like they do a lamb burger. They are selling ground lamb meat. They're selling a whole chicken that is like covered in all of the spices that typically it's made with. And like, just toss that into the oven when you're ready. And I think that the way that people have been pivoting and being really innovative in this time has been like kind of like, you know, obviously like it sucks that this is how it has to be right now, but it's almost like kind of creatively inspiring to a certain degree of like, wow, this is it's amazing the way that people are thinking out of the box in this time.
And it is definitely. And you know, all of those sort of ideas, it's hard, you know, as someone who has been a restaurateur for a long time, or not for a long time, but someone who's been in restaurants for a long time, you can always sort of see when restaurants are struggling, they do things like they change their hours. They try to do things like takeout menus and all of those things that every restaurant is doing right now are things that I tried to avoid for the longest time. You know, we were open 4 days a week, but now, you know, if we're not doing enough business on Tuesdays to turn the power on, then we're not going to be open on Tuesdays anymore. And so now we're just Thursday through Sunday. And those are the days that enough money is coming in to justify turning the gas on and the, you know, and the electricity on. And you know, that's where we are. And we've been contemplating trying things like ready to go takeout food that you can cook when you're ready. That still requires a lot of stock ready to go. Like if I dress 6 chickens ready to be taken home and, you know, we only sell one of them, that leaves me a lot of leftover stuff that is already seasoned, which is not where you want to leave it. So we're trying everything. I don't want to sound like such a downer. I am really optimistic about where we are as a restaurant and me as a person and where what's happening in the food scene. And I really think, and I want to stay positive and know that everyone else like me, or, you know, not everyone else like me, but lots of places are going to do everything they can to make it through this. And I'm one of those people. We're not locking the doors yet. No one else is working but me, but we haven't fired anybody, you know, so everyone who left the job on the last day still has their job the second the dining room can open. And so we've been trying to figure out what kind of charity we can do. But in all honesty, I feel guilty that we really can't afford to give away. I was going to do kind of like a local Meals on Wheels program delivering to my restaurant situated in a neighborhood. So we would think working about delivering to, you know, at-risk groups of people in the neighborhood. And I still want to do that if we can afford it, but that's, you know,
everyone understands that.
Yeah. We're also trying to reach out to some of the hospitals to do some of the carry out meals to hospitals. And, you know, I wish I was in a position to do more, but I don't know where to get it from. So, yeah.
Well, Jim, let's move on sad subjects to sad subjects, because your Sir Charleston bro, Jamie, went home, and this, let's just so you know, like when we booked you in advance, none of us had any knowledge as to this happening. This is not like a suspect situation. We had no idea that the Charleston curse would end up occurring over the course of this subsequent podcast paired with the episode.
Well, it wasn't a non-zero chance exactly.
Well, he had no immunity to give up this time. So
he finished in the top in the first episode. He's not, you know, he's not a Stephanie who's sort of, you know, has had a rough couple weeks.
Am
I correct in remembering he was a last draft standing guy?
Yeah. So the way that shook out, for those who don't recall, is Kurt and I were down to, it was the last two picks for us. Kurt already had Brian Baltaggio. I basically bullied Kurt into taking Brian Malarkey so he could have a Brian sandwich. And I ended up with Jim. I wish I ended up with Jim. I mean, I ended up on a podcast with you finally, Jim. I wish that the circumstances were a little better right now, but gosh, it's just a delight to see you. This is fantastic for me. Anyone who's been listening to the Top Chef podcast for a while knows, big fan over here. So this is very exciting for me. Not to make things weird, but maybe making things a little bit weird.
He's definitely wearing pants.
Josh, you talk about Jim on other podcasts that we do.
I talk about multiple gyms. I talk about gyms all the time. So I ended up with Jamie last. Joe Sasto goes first, and now Jamie goes third. So I'm down to just Leanne in the main game right now.
And things are really
not looking good. I think we
should be looking next week.
I think the house has
Ryan Malarkey.
The house, as I named
Ryan Malarkey in his giant hat,
shall be burning down shortly. I don't think it's looking good for Team Wigler. First one out would be my bet.
So in this episode, we did get a quick fire, unlike last week. It was nice to have it. We have Ali Wong and Randall Park of one of my favorite movies from last year. All four I saw. Always Be My Maybe. I thought it was wonderful little rom-com on Netflix.
I forget the name of that. It was great.
But yeah, the bounce back like a basketball.
The tennis ball song he had. Yeah, it was great.
A wonderful movie. You should watch it after listening to this podcast.
It was really the beginning of like the Keanu Reeves renaissance of 2019, right? Because like that came out like the first couple months, and he had that huge role as himself. That was just, it's perfect, especially as like a Top Chef fan, because he's huge into this. Like they have this whole scene where they go to this molecular gastronomy restaurant, and it's like perfectly poking fun at the Marcels of the world.
It's wonderful, yeah. And I recently read Ali Wong's book, Dear Girls, and that's a really nice little book too. So I was excited to see both of them. And so the challenge was make a crazy fried rice. Randall had hosted a fried rice competition back in his university days in which Ali participated and did not win. So it was really fun to see what some of the chef testants came up with for this. What would you guys most want to try out of what we saw?
Oh man.
It's got to be the peanut butter and jelly fried rice for me.
And I know they said it was salty, but I think if I was going to try Spam, I would want it like this.
Emily, I was thinking the same thing. The scallions and the canned meat. I would have been actually interested in Jamie's dish here.
We were watching the episode and Emily, you were like, oh, I bet that's really good.
Yeah.
I thought that too. It looked really nice. Like the Spam looked like perfectly crisp. I think I probably would have gravitated towards that. And after hearing them talk about Karen's nasi goreng, I think I would have liked to try that one too.
I like how on this, Kurt was sort of pointing this out, how on the show, like they can't say brand name products, you know, so they have to be like, despite the chef saying it, it's like, you know, hot cheese puffs. Or, you know, canned meat, just to make it sound like a descriptor instead of the actual brand itself. Even though it's sort of like the Kleenex tissue situation, right? Like we don't call something canned meat in real life. We just call it Spam, even if it's not Spam.
And this is also the longest in this episode. I kind of pointed this out. I think cameras week one or two. This is the longest in an episode we've ever actually spent in the Top Chef kitchen, because you know the first elimination challenge was on the beach. Last time they were all around LA and they did the majority of their cooking and prepping in Union Station. But here we spend the entire quick fire in the kitchen and we spend the elimination challenge in the kitchen. So you know, it was, I thought it was really, really, we finally got to actually feel like a little bit more established in this episode.
Not that I would have wanted to try it, but the guts of putting out a fried rice dish that includes fried frog legs and red hots is, man, some of the ingredients that they were thrown, pretty weird to put into the fried rice equation, Antonia.
Definitely. And what was also unusual about that is it wasn't your traditional quick fire where, like, if you don't grab it, you can't use it. Several people use frog legs. Several people use the hot cheese puffs or the Cheetos, if you will, the Flamin' Hots. It's funny you guys didn't mention the two dishes that I mean, you sort of Haley, you mentioned the Nasi Goreng. That really jumped off the page for me. It looked delicious and I like that dish. But Kevin's Bachelor fried rice, of course, is something
Wieners.
That was near and dear to my heart. The wieners were near and dear to my heart. He's got bourbon in there. Are you kidding me? Like, so I
he did
again,
say he just wanted an excuse to say wieners a lot, even if the dish failed. And look at him, he's the wiener of the competition.
Yeah,
sounds like an old Mike Bloom move.
Yeah, it really does.
Kevin, I doubt you're listening, but I'm here to tell you, brother, you don't need an excuse to say wieners. Just say it.
Jim, what would you have done in a challenge like this? And compared to some of the quick fires that you have competed in, what do you think was the level of difficulty for something like this one?
I don't think this is the most difficult quick fire, but I think the difficulty is choosing whether strategically to make your move for the Red Hots or the Cheetos. Like, Padma didn't really say you'll be rewarded for using this craziness, but I think that they might have gotten that instruction, you know, while they were getting the rules. But you know, for me, like I would want anything that Gregory made, I would want to eat. And to me, that looked like it had the potential to be maybe the best one with the frog legs and the salt cod. It may have been the same salt cod that got me in trouble on Last Chance Kitchen.
hopefully a little fresher.
Well, it's salt cod. It'll last forever. Yeah, but yeah, I think that, and the other thing too is we don't really know. It was how it was 30 minutes. Do you think they had pre-made rice somewhere? They must have had pre-made rice, right?
We didn't see it. I don't remember seeing any rice, like any, like, oh, my rice is potentially going bad. There's no rice commentary. You're right.
All we saw was Brian Voltaggio throw rice in the deep fryer, which I loved the continual story of Brian Voltaggio being an alien just because he made the comment like, I don't make fried rice often, but I have great respect for it. It's like... It's like saying, like, oh, my best friend, my best friends are fried rice. I don't know fried rice too well.
When it comes to fried rice, though, you're not frying up fresh rice, right? You want like the day old or 2 day old or something to that effect rice to get your best fried rice. So I got to imagine the magical elves, if you will, in some way prepare that in the back. And it was maybe around for a couple of days. Maybe that's what they had Angelo do.
Angela's just on rice cooker duty.
Yeah, this rice is very sweet. It's very sweet. I don't understand.
I hope you like turmeric.
Yeah, there's a lot of turmeric in here. James, where do you come down on the turmeric versus turmeric debate?
How do you pronounce
it? I usually say turmeric.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right, you can stay on the podcast.
That's good.
You're allowed to remain here.
So can we talk about how awesome Ali Wong and Randall Park were? Josh, I know you got the opportunity to talk with Randall Park, but I thought they were just so much fun. I know that we sometimes get it iffy with these celebrity guest judge cut to Lea Michele's gluten-free vegetarian extravaganza back in season 11.
I'm vegan, but I also want a lot of cheese here.
But I thought that they were, you know, they have like enough cooking experience to like make commentary. And they were also just like, I don't know, I love the bits they were doing. I love them commending the empty workstation, for example. Like they worked really well together, and that was
really
palpable.
Fun. And Ali
talks a lot. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go for it.
Ali talks a lot about food in her book, so it really did feel like this connection made sense to me. Yeah. And I really want to know where I can get those silk pajamas that I can wear out in public from, because those were magical.
Well, wait, you're going out in public?
Yeah, let's work on going out in public first.
Okay, I can wear around the house and feel fancy.
I mean, in the movie with Randall Park, she's a chef, right? Isn't she like a celebrity chef in?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, good call, good call.
Like, she's had that, like, and she's the one who comes out here and is like, I'm a huge Top Chef fan, I'm nerding out being here. Like, it was clearly palpable.
And she loves Padma. Padma, like, in the movie, spoiler alert, Ali's boyfriend left her for Padma, I think.
Yeah, right. I think that's right. Yeah. Daniel Day Kim is the
actor. Oh, so many connections. And she got to do the Leslie Jones on Drag Race. Padma let her say, you know, you have 30 minutes and your time begins now. And you could tell how much fun she had with that.
Meanwhile, Randall Park. So I did get to do an email interview with him for THR. And we'll post that in the show notes. And he was like, yeah, so I've never seen Top Chef before.
Oh, no.
And he like kind of just walked into it. But he said that, like, his impression was always that, you know, these cooking shows are, like, at least, like, you know, 50%, if not more, like, made up. And, like, the time element is always just, like, a little bit of ooey. And he was really impressed with how close to, like, the reality matches what is broadcast on TV, of, like, the panic of the clock and everything like that. So he had nothing but really kind words to say, not just for Top Chef as a program, but also Padma specifically as somebody to just like kind of shoot the shit with backstage and everything like that. Yeah, it was really, really fun to talk to him. And I thought that they were both great because they clearly have such chemistry with each other. I guess I didn't realize how far back their dynamic goes, that it goes back, you know, all the way back to, you know, being in school together. And I need to know more about the chocolate fried rice. He wasn't, when I asked him about it, he wasn't particularly illuminating on this.
Something tells me he might not remember a lot of things that happened in college.
Well, he says also that, like, as a judge, he was like, yeah, I just kind of, like, I'm probably going to be terrible at this because I just like food, you know, like, basically anything you throw at me, I'm probably going to eat.
If you're in a state where you're going to be trying chocolate fried rice, you're also probably not in a state where you're going to be remembering the chocolate fried rice.
I don't know. I'm clean as a whistle these days. I didn't talk about it.
You made a chocolate sandwich.
I made a chocolate sandwich the other day, and it was terrible, but I ate it.
You got your peanut butter fried rice and my chocolate fried rice.
Yeah, I do that.
I think that sounds good, personally.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I'd try it. And just building on their chemistry, like between like the empty workstation. Obviously, I liked just seeing that spark between Ali and Nini. Like there was just like little things, like I like your glasses, and. And was it Leanne where they said that they'd ordered food from her restaurant before?
Yeah.
And then Leanne's like, I need to cook, but I want to hug you, but I need to cook. So yeah, this was just I loved the energy during the quick fire here. And you know, maybe we now have a Top Chef convert in Randall. I don't know. But yeah, that was fun. It was a fun quick fire. Yeah.
So, Jim, I want to ask you, because I want to talk to you about Kevin. We need to talk about Kevin. Because so he won the first, what do you say? He won the first three challenges or something like that. But then he ends up doing like pretty bad in the elimination shot to the point where he gets called out by Padma. He admits, you know, he's like, I want to try something new. But, you know, as someone who's competed, how important is momentum to this type of stuff? Because we've seen the past couple seasons that like people do well and then just like hit a wall. Do you think Kevin's in it on the long haul, or do you think his performance in this elimination challenge is like a harbinger of how he might do later on?
No, I think he's in it for the long haul. I think on Top Chef, from a game perspective, it's important to come out of the gate super strong, super fast. And I think that he's already done it. So I think he gets a little bit of leeway. I do think that his like, oh, I was just trying stuff out, I think that's a little bit of BS. Like, I don't think he was like, oh, I'm going to make a crappy dish because I have immunity. I think that he probably was just a little CYA a little bit there. But yeah, I think Kevin's in it for the long haul. And I do think too, sort of unlike Survivor, I think that this is going to be sort of like the opposite of Survivor, where the newbies are in way more trouble. I think Nini has done a good job of stepping out early as maybe the newbie who is in it. But the rest of the people who are in the past three or four seasons, I think, are going to be in a heap of trouble. So
what's the big deal maker between like the way that that's bearing out on? Spoiler alert, if you listen to the Top Chef podcast on RHAP, but you don't listen to the Survivor content on RHAP.
Oh, my bad.
You're talking about rice on both shows, so it's a commonality.
That here in the current 40th season of Survivor, the old schoolers did not fare nearly as well as the new schoolers. What is like the difference in the game design that would make you think that new school has a disadvantage versus the real veterans? Like Kevin, like Voltaggio, like the people who been around the block here a bit more.
Well, you know, even people like Leanne, who's a culinary director on the show. I mean, that is, I mean, that's a lot. Like, I mean, the same reasons why people were saying it may be unfair for Parvati to be on Survivor is sort of the same reasons why, you know, these people not only have judged Leanne, but they worked with Leanne. So even though her elimination dish, to me, I was like, what is happening there? You know, it was, I think that the judges have some more love and leeway. And I'm not saying that they're biased because they try their best not to be. But it's impossible not to be biased in some degree. And people who we haven't seen, I was super shocked that Angelo left so early. He was one of my favorites for a long time. And he is someone who I correspond with a little bit on social media, even before I knew that he was going to be on this season. He's a super nice guy, a really cool guy. But I think that production, I'm not going to say there's some sort of conspiracy theory or anything out there, but the people who were on Top Chef 10 years ago have been doing this sort of thing for 10 years longer than the new people. They've been on lots of other shows. They've been judges on other shows. They make lots of other TV appearances. They know how to work those systems, and they know how to make fun of the judges. I mean, Brian Mullarkey has had so much stuff on all of his plates, and he is, Casey Thompson says that his restaurants are awesome, and I would love to go and eat at his. He has a restaurant empire, and he was someone who I liked from the early days.
Feels like you're couching something.
Well, yeah, that pregnant pause.
No, he put vadovan on both of his dishes episode, which is a surprise for me. I hope Brian Mullarkey is in it for the long haul. I think he may be because he's a super talented chef, but he's just so out there. He's great for TV. People know him. He has a restaurant empire, and he knows how to work the judges. Like him, the way that he worked Gail and Padma during the elimination challenge, cracked me up. He's, oh, this is so great. You're going to love it. And you know, that sometimes things like that, even if it's not great, is the right way to approach the judges.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously a big difference between the formats of these shows is one is you're being voted out by your peers, and one you're being, you know, your fate is in the hands of the people who make the show.
And I think also, you know, once you're off of Top Chef, you continue chefing. Whereas, you know, a Survivor, you...
I think they continue surviving as well.
Yeah, they do.
Have you heard of Hearts of Reality, Kurt?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think it's like, it's game planning and retrospecting on your game, but it's not like they necessarily, unless they're involved in Survivor Philly. I mean, looking at you, Bryson Wendell, you don't have necessarily as much of a chance to hone your game as moving forward. Whereas I think with this, you're stepping out of your career and back into it and keeping on going. So I think it's more just not just Top Chef experience, but just restaurant experience.
I love Brian Mullarkey this season. Oh my God. He reminds me of, like, this is a very specific, stupid comparison, but he reminds me like he could be related to Mr. Music from John Mulaney of the Sack Lunch Bunch, the Jake Gyllenhaal character with the xylophone, because he is just so eclectically dressed, jumping all over the place. Like, it's just, he's absolutely wacky. And I love the energy
top
that he's.
Top Chef here, Top Chef.
Yeah, exactly.
Top Chef everywhere.
Mr. Mullarkey. I think that, granted, again, like, he is so up and down. He gets commendations this episode, but I feel like when Tom's like, good job, Brian, remember to edit your things, he is not taking that note whatsoever. And I also love this idea of, like you said, Jim's like, Mullarkey went Hollywood, and like how he interacts now, especially with Ludo. You know, that's gotta be a weird situation. We dealt with this with Bruce a couple seasons ago, but I can't imagine having someone you were on a show with coming on and judging your food. You can't be objective with that whatsoever.
It's weird, though. He's getting that kind of edit, and you're right. Like, it's definitely there. And he's getting a lot of the fun, like, little moments where they put a halo around his head in post-production, or they cut to him for reactions on the critiques that chefs are getting. So the edit is there as far as being fun and goofy. But you're right. Like, his other edit in terms of his food is sort of up and down. And it's hard to know what the show wants us to think about him. I feel that way just generally watching this season. They're dealing with a a lot of really talented chefs, obviously, as we always are on Top Chef. But when you have an all returnee season, an all-star season, if you will, it is certainly amplified in terms of that. And so it's interesting to me, the edit that we get from different characters. For example, the episode begins with Stephanie, Karen, and Nini talking about how that doubt plants a seed in your head. And that sort of ties in, Jim, to what you're saying when you were asked about Kevin. And whether or not Kevin starting the way that he started, is he going to be okay? Is it hard when you fail early on, or what are you doing? Can you get in your own head? These chefs are talking about that because we know that's a thing that happens on Top Chef, and we have a very serious bonding conversation. And I'm thinking, oh, we're actually adding depth and layers to Stephanie, Karen, and Nini. And then the scene ends with Nini farting. So I don't know what to think.
Was that someone in production that just like slid their foot on the floor? Is that really what it was?
There was a very weird
that's
noise.
That's what I always say, Emily. Slid my old foot on the floor there. Yeah,
When Brian Voltaggio is walking through the museum and you hear the flip-flops, like very loud sounds, do you think those were the shoes? Or do you think he was just tooting the entire way in the Getty Museum?
The only part of the episode I rewatched was that scene to see if I could get to the bottom of whether or not that was real. And the fact that they, as they're pulling the camera away from the drone shot, kind of away from the manor where they're staying, you do hear Nina say, like, guys, I'm sorry. Like, so the fact that she apologized made me think that it was...
Wait, Kurt, did you Zapruder film the fart scene from Top Chef 17?
Back and to the left.
Yes, I did.
But I've also been interested, farts aside, I've also been interested in...
How do you put them aside, though?
Just lift a cheek up. I have been interested generally
That was just an aside. Let's move aside.
I've been interested generally in how Karen is being presented in this season as well. The way that Karen has been edited and presented. Like I said, last episode... She got a lot of talk and a lot of content, and then she wasn't really relevant in terms of the top or bottom dishes. And then this episode, obviously, there's a struggle bus edit happening because where she ends up and because of the groups. But it's just I just don't know what to think about her place on this show. She's getting a lot of content, so I'm guessing that she will continue to be at the center of a lot of the show. Compare Karen, for example, to Gregory. Gregory, who wins the first challenge, but we're not seeing Gregory nearly as much as we're seeing Karen on this season. So I don't know what to think. And I'm not trying to read into it and say what we're seeing. I mean, I'm not doing the edgic conversation.
Top Chef edgic.
Yeah, I'm not doing that. It's interesting to me from the storytelling point of view, what stories they're telling with these chefs. We're seeing a lot of the same. I mean, it, obviously it comes down to the content the chefs are giving them because Stephanie is giving them a lot of anxiety. We're going to get a lot of that from Stephanie. And it's always entertaining to the point that it becomes difficult to watch. But she's present on the show in that way. And other chefs are present in other ways. But for Karen, I'm fascinated by what's happening there. And then the Brian Malarkey part. I mean, this is all, Mike, you sparked this. You sparked the Malark. But we had a tweet from Travis Payne last week before the episode goes, I mean, really right after when they teased this week's episode. And he said, do you think the show will acknowledge the Ludo versus Brian Malarkey judges feud from The Taste in 2013? And at the time, I didn't think that they would go there. Now, they didn't go there hardcore on the feud. Brian sort of he yada yada'd it, and there was a ... ellipsis about the show being canceled, but it seemed like they were good friends. So I don't think that went into the judging, and Ludo seemed to like Malarkey dish, as he said. So all is well, it seems like, in Malarkey world.
And just to clarify, so The Taste, for people who don't know, was essentially The Voice of cooking, where it was, let's see, I think it was Ludo, it was Malarkey, I think it was Bourdain,
yeah, mm-hmm.
and maybe one other person, and basically they would like try the food blind, recruit chefs for their team, and then those chefs would compete against one another. I don't believe Malarkey won. Oh, actually, no, spoiler alert, he won 2 seasons out of 3. That existed on
there
The Taste.
There was more than one season.
Spoiler alert, there was more than one season.
Spoiler. Yeah.
There were 3 seasons of The Taste.
Bourdain picked a girl that I went to high school with, and I was being like, yo, is that Mia Morgenstern? And it was.
Shout out to Mia Morgenstern.
Yeah.
What up?
Yeah. Very strange.
It's a great name.
Yeah.
All right. Well, in the spirit of Top Chef, we can't do anything around here without being corporate shills for something. So take a break and listen to this ad, and we'll be right back. Hopefully Brooke isn't it, at least. Well, that didn't sound like Brooke, but we're back anyway. Hopefully we'll be able to get Brooke on one of these one time.
To get into the elimination challenge in greater detail.
No, I think I'm the host. I think we're just going to talk some more S around the table. I'm just kidding.
Some
Josh, S? I wasn't, instead of shit.
Wait, I mean, like, if you want me to elaborate on Emily Fox's fart procedure, I certainly can.
No, Josh.
For our $10,000 patrons.
Well, Antonio said, like, oh, when we're working between Karen with the groups, and I was like, the poops.
This is where we're at, guys.
I'm a child.
Is that how she got on the bottom?
Josh, tell us about the the challenge. Tell us everything.
I don't have anything to say other than I guess I was bored. I was a little bored by the challenge.
Oh, interesting.
Really? I didn't love the challenge. I was a little bored.
You uncultured pleb.
I don't know that I'd say I hate art, but maybe I do get bored by it.
You hate museums.
I don't like to.
I'm very bad
at museums.
I got us a museum pass when we went to Paris like 4 or 5 years ago. And
what
I was
happened
like,
to that museum pass?
Well, we lost it in our rental car in Italy, so that was one thing. So we had to get another one, and I was like, let's get a consolidated 3-day pass, and we used it.
We tried to use it three times, but one of the museums was closed. Yeah, we were there in August.
We used it for two museums, and like halfway through our visit to the first museum, he looks at me and he goes,
"I like Game of Thrones.
I just don't think I'm a museum person." And I was like, "Ugh,
it's just not for me."
Do you think you would have liked the challenge better if the art styles they chose were
like comic
vastly different from each other? Like or like pop art or surrealism,
yes.
Or you know whatever. I felt like the strains of art they chose. Honestly, I'm not an art historian. If I looked at them, I probably couldn't tell you what period they came from.
Right.
I'm not a fart historian. I'm like Emily, I guess.
Yes. My God. Yes. She's embracing it. I think that definitely would have helped. I think for me too, it was also a little difficult to. I think that this is like a very.
Well, they showed like one piece of art per. Like
I think it's
style,
I think it's
and they're like,
one.
Okay, got it, great, bye.
And like, I'd love to get other people's takes on this, but yeah. I think that this is a hard challenge to convey for television, let alone for how to convey it for the table. Yeah. Like I think like it was difficult for me as somebody who's not an art history student, as somebody who is not like a great appreciator of this stuff, to really like feel that translation in the same way that last week. Felt so tangible, even if you've never been to those restaurants before, everybody has a communal feeling about like your favorite restaurant and wanting to be inspired by your favorite restaurant. And that felt very Top Chef-y to me. This felt almost like a different show to me and kind of lost me to a certain extent.
And here's what I think last week, like if you've never had Thai food and they're talking about Thai cuisine and Thai inspiration, it's not going to mean anything to you. But at least there, they then put specific dishes down and they talked about that you could relate to. Here, if you don't know anything about Rococo versus Baroque versus Renaissance, I can see which I frankly, all I know is what they told me on the show for the most part. But if instead we had been shown like here's a specific piece of art and a specific work. That speaks to me, and you developed off of that work. Like we see on Project Runway several times, they'll go around the city and have to like take photographs of things or in a specific area that inspire them, and they kind of work off of that photo and that inspiration. Here, instead of a style, if it was a specific piece that was inspiring them, and we had that as a kind of a point of reference, I would have rather had that. Because at least
I disagree.
Oh, well, I disagree with you disagreeing.
I think if you do that, you got the challenge that eliminated Melissa back in season 12, if you remember, which is when they went to Mexico and they're like, they went to Mexico and they were like, here's four paintings, make a piece of food off of the painting. And remember, we were at the time in the baby days of the round table, we were pretty angry about that because that is really pigeonholing you. What I really liked about this challenge is the fact that the pigeons were free. Is the fact that you could base it off of the history, you could base it off of the aesthetics, you could base it off of a particular piece if you wanted to. What I really loved about this challenge is, look, one of the fundamental flaws of Top Chef as a show is that you can't taste with your eyes. Not yet. What I liked about this challenge is the fact
that... Sounds like you know something.
I've been doing some work in the quarantine, some scientific breakthroughs.
Just imagine you putting your face directly on a plate and like blinking really hard.
Antonio's laughing pretty hard. Antonio, what are you picturing? What are you tasting with your eyes right now?
It was just more that Mike is taking our this podcast to like a whole new world. He's like genre bending. Like we're now a sci-fi podcast.
Would you rather have little tongues coming out of your eyes or little eyes on your tongue?
I'm out. I have to go. Thank you for coming to the podcast. That's a triggering.
And I'm going to disagree. I agree. I think it would have been horrible if they'd been going, here's a set of paintings and you kind of have to pick one. But like if I just went to the Getty Center for the first time this past Thanksgiving when my mom was visiting over the holidays, it's an amazing space. There's a lot of artwork. And if they'd been given that open canvas, open palette of exploring and finding a piece that speaks to them. So instead of like, here's six pieces or a limited number of pieces, find something that speaks to you. And even if it's just the story behind it or the colors of it, but having a piece as a point of reference and something about that piece, again, whether it be the story, the color, or what's actually depicted versus being an art style that's harder to wrap my mind around, I, as a viewer, would have enjoyed it more.
Jim, I have a question for you specifically about this, because I remember you did really well in Charleston with the Edna Lewis Challenge, where you're given a very open idea of just pay homage to Edna Lewis and do something that would be in her spirit. That seems to be different than pick a painting and create a dish that is inspired by an art movement. How do you draw the line with that? And I know Chef Brooke Williamson has been on record saying she really struggles with this forced inspiration kind of thing. The show obviously does throw that at you as a chef testant. So how do you balance that when you're on the show?
You know, I really think that for these types of challenges, I think that probably 9 out of 10 dishes that are made are dishes that people had in their mind already, but then they make a story that connects it to the piece of art or whatever they're looking for. Like, I mean, like Nini, you know, she looks at a picture of the Last Supper and then says, this reminds me of Rebirth. And that means gumbo. You're like, okay, I guess, you know, sure. But Brian Voltaggio crap about just choosing the colors, which to me seems like a pretty fair inspiration for these dishes. But Tom was like, all he did was say this picture has color and that's what he did. But, you know, it's so hard to gain inspiration. Or I think that it's better to have a dish in your mind that you can tell a story as to how it relates. And as long as that story is believable, the judges are going to believe your inspiration. But if you're going to, I mean, they seem to be okay with Nini's inspiration, which for me was just totally, I mean, just out there completely. So yeah. I think that, and sometimes you do get struck. Now, in the Evelyn Lewis challenge, they gave us the cookbook. And they said, you can read this cookbook and you can gain inspiration from that. And that becomes much easier as a chef because you can say, oh, I like this idea and we compare it with that idea. And you can see these techniques that she was actually using to make those dishes. But in this instance, I don't know. It's just difficult. I know that Brooke has a lot of troubles with this, but I'm not so sure that that's true. Brooke has trouble with nothing.
I think if I remember correctly, and I hope Brooke correct me if I'm wrong, is that like there's ones where it's like pick something from your childhood where it's very broad, but you have to use something as a point of inspiration versus if it's like, here's one of 6 or 7 things that you have to draw inspiration from. I think it was more where it was like an open inspiration versus a very forced close. Cause I think she, it's like the difference between, and Mike, you could probably relate between kind of long form improv and game form improv, where like long form, it's like it can go anywhere. But at least if you're doing a specific game, there's usually a very specific set of instructions. And sometimes having that frame can help you at least know a specific direction to go in. I think what Brooke had been saying was like for those where it's a very specific sort of direct inspiration, she does well. So those broad open ones where it's pick something from this year that was great. It would have been interesting to see how, I think I actually would have liked to have seen how Brooke had done in this and where she would have, picked up and where she would have struggled.
Sorry, Jim. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, do you think they told the people like, okay, you cannot choose still lifes of fruit for your inspiration.
Yeah. like a beautiful apple.
Like a painting of a turkey dinner or something.
Yes, those famous Renaissance turkey dinners that are there.
I want to see the Da Vinci's ham sandwich.
Yes.
I want to see the Do you think that the judges went through like a crash course on each of the artistic styles, like in terms of, okay, just let you know, when you're talking about the Rococo team and their dishes, here's the sorts of things that you're going to probably want to play back.
I'm going to throw some shade at Tom, like I am wont to do on this podcast, when he was like, actually, that was far too much like this other movement. I was like, come on, Tom. Come on, man.
He's got a little listener table. He kind of checks off that comment. Yeah,
it's, Leanne, your plating was more Rococo. Oh,
he has in one ear the audio tour from the Getty Museum that he's just kind of like playing through, like, hey, Baroque, what is Baroque? Oh, yes, of course, Baroque. Then you were not Baroque whatsoever.
Yeah, it's when you run out of Monet, I think.
Oh my god!
Doesn't quite add up, I don't think.
I don't know if you guys, how many of you watched Last Chance Kitchen? And I'm not quite. I'm not jumping, but they had some flashbacks to the. I'm looking at you, Josh. They did flashbacks to Jamie's dish, and Padma had. And I didn't see this during the actual episode, but Padma did unfortunately make the. This wasn't Baroque as much as it was broke, and I'm like, oh, Padma.
I caught that. I laughed.
I would have made hot Rococo.
Ew.
Just chocolate, hot chocolate, guys.
Edit this out.
Yeah, hot chocolate sandwich.
I'm Rococo for Rococo Puffs.
Can I ask, I want to bring this up. I want to breach this subject because we have populations represented on this podcast. Lisa is a Canadian Jew. And she made like Mexican, and her name is Lisa Fernandez, right? And she made like a Hispanic inspired,
like a Portuguese name,
Portuguese inspired. She's got Portuguese, Jewish food, Mexican brisket. What's happening here? Like I was very intrigued by that dish.
It's and, like a quinceañera combined with a bar mitzvah.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I thought I actually thought she said, you know, in terms of the inspiration, she was inspired by the clashes, the cultural clash that she saw in these paintings. And I don't remember that being something that was suggested as, was a feature of her time period, but, that seems to me more like what you're talking about, Jim, with the shoehorn dish that she comes up with the story for, that this is a dish she wanted to make and came into the competition wanting to make. But I was very intrigued by it, and I would definitely like to eat that dish. She got the Jew on the plate. Jamie did not.
Wow, yeah.
Sorry, I made that joke in the text chain before. I wanted to make it again.
It was very
I
was
love
very
it. Funny so good. There's repeating.
As a Jewish person, I absolve you of any guilt.
Thank you. Catholic absolution.
You absorb all of it.
Yeah, I'm used to this.
We have more Jew on the podcast than Jamie had on his plate.
It's true. We do.
Wow.
What do you think was the hardest art style? I guess it seems like Baroque might have been the hardest to get a grasp on due to, like you said, Brian's comment about like this doesn't represent Baroque very well, and obviously Jamie just being like, the Baroque means simple, so I'm gonna put chicken on a plate without any sauce. Did that seem like the hardest one to cook for, or were there any other ones of the four that seemed like tougher to grasp from your perspective?
Rococo seemed the easiest to grasp for me, just based on at least how it was described to us.
Yeah, plus I think that's the most conducive to cooking, right? Like if these people are used to more fine dining and it's like, oh, this is all about lavishness and opulence, you own everything, then I think that, you know, it's an easy ability for someone. And that's, I guess, I don't think it's coincidental that, you know, Stephanie, Melissa, and Gregory produced visually the best three dishes. Like, yeah. They just looked stunning because they were able to really tap into that. Whereas it's a little tougher to be like, they were very simple, so you must cook simple food, as, you know, as a representative of it.
The moment,
it's like, I want all of my food to be a nice, subtle shade of brown, yeah, to, you know, really bring out the period.
The moment that the lobster wonton was like even presented as a possibility, coming from Melissa too, I was like, I have a very good feeling that this is going to be delicious. Yeah. So it was no surprise to me that she was the winner of the competition. That
my
sounded
team,
like
my
something.
Team.
Worth, like, I would like to go to a fancy ass restaurant and eat that lobster wonton. Sounds fantastic.
There were definitely some of those people that were in the top of their class for their specific style that you knew was like, there was kind of like, you know, you just had, they had to pick somebody. And so I wasn't looking at, as much as I love having Brian Voltaggio on my team, I knew that just the way they had talked about it, he wasn't going to be winning the taking away from Melissa in that final round. Like, he just, they had to pick somebody from that era, and it just had to be him.
I think Brian Moltaggio has more respect for fried rice than he does for the poor Baroque era.
And I kind of feel that way, Kurt, but the opposite for Stephanie. Like, I felt like if they didn't have to pick somebody to be in the bottom, I don't know if she would have been in the bottom. Like, they seem to like it. They're like, I guess your pasta was like sort of undercooked or something. Yeah. Like, there could have been more. You could have chosen a bowl instead of a plate for presentation. Like, sorry, Steph. Like, it was kind of like,
first episode when they put Malarkey in the bottom, but they're like, but he's not really she was definitively fourth last, I think, just by default.
Speaking of that first episode, Mike, and how groups can bring people down, which we saw in Charleston with Jamie, and we have seen in the past, right, where the immunity bearing person's dish is the one that brings the whole group down, and thus their immunity is a problem because they should have gone home, and they're the one that dragged the team into the bottom, and someone else who cooked a better dish than they did ends up going home. We know that happened with Stephanie. We've seen that happen on the show before. That seems to be what Karen is suggesting, although it may be what the producers told her to say, with what is happening with Kevin. Not the same scenario in my mind at all. Karen.
I agree with you there, because it's not like Kevin's group was all in the bottom because of Kevin's dish. It was like, well, Karen, you know, if Kevin didn't have immunity, it would have been you, but also your dish was shit too. Like,
yeah.
It's Kevin's not like she cooked a brilliant dish and like ended up in the bottom because of some weird technicality. Like,
or even a good one. Right. Or even a good one. Right. Yeah. I did not feel it was the same way. She was not going to go home if she went home because Kevin had immunity. She was going to go home because she was the worst one on a team of three and Kevin joined their team. He could have gone to any team. She was the worst one from the group of three, period. And that's the way it goes. So I don't know. I just got a little triggered by that, but I guess I'm so protective of Kevin. I want him to do so well.
And I wasn't sure if it was going to be like Kevin could have been in the bottom for his team, but he would have been not considered in the final, the four people who were on the bottom. Or if it was going to, like, at what point was his immunity going to come into play? You know what I'm saying?
If his whole team had cooked brilliant dishes, sure, that's different, but that's not the case. Like, I feel like, you know, if Kevin had a worse dish, I think it was like slightly worse than Karen's.
And even if the entire team had cooked brilliantly, then you have a brilliant dish that's not going to go home in the bottom four. I mean, I think I was thinking the same thing that you were, Antonio. It was kind of a strange thing for her to be vocalizing. Like, if she had cooked brilliantly and Kevin had cooked very poorly and she was still in the bottom four, it's like she would have been in this, like, a Stephanie position where they would have had to come up with some way to say something they could, other than, like, they can't say you're the bottom four, but your dish is sensational. Just like they had to come up with something positive, I think, to say about the Bryans' dishes. I didn't think either of the Bryans were going to win, but they were just by default the best in their style, and you had to kind of say something positive about them.
Well, yeah, and I think, Jim, you experienced this a little bit with when you and Amanda had to cook, like, the Feast of the Seven Fishes, right, in terms of, like, and that was more collaborative, yes, obviously, but there is this certain perspective, right, of, like, the elephant in the room of, like, this person, by their own performance, could link yours, whether consequentially or not.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I don't think this is like a Nicholas Selmy situation either, where, you know, someone goes home because they have immunity. I don't think this was ever at all one of those possibilities. But it would have been awesome, like, if Kevin would have been like, okay, I have immunity, so I'm going to pick the team with the people who I think are the best group, and then just totally tanked it, like turned in nothing and been like, all right, there you go. But I think that would get you punished in Top Chef more than them like rewarding you for smart strategic play. I think they'd be like, what's your problem? This is not that kind of game. You know, you should, I mean, that's interesting game theory, but this is not the place for that. You know?
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I also think, to your point, Antonio, I totally agree, but I also feel like personally, this deliberation was between Leanne versus Jamie. Yeah. Because I think while Karen, it seemed like she missed
the
mark.
I was screwed either way.
I know Josh's choice here. But really, you know, while it did come down to like Karen might have missed the mark when it came, and especially from a color perspective, it seemed like it really was Leanne and Jamie just also not cooking good food. And we talk about this all the time, right? Of like, would you rather have a good dish that fails the theme versus a bad dish, but at least tries to buy into it? And it feels like this was with the latter. that was sort of the case at the bottom to this episode.
I had another question, generally speaking, about just the realities of how this challenge played out. Jamie's issue, right, is that he cooks his chicken sous vide, which I would imagine should have kept the juices in the thing. I don't know. I'm famous on this podcast for not being a sous vide expert by any stretch of the imagination. But I'm
Everybody knows this about you. I understand.
I overreported. Yeah. I understand that that's the issue, right? He doesn't get the jus on the plate. And that's the problem. His chicken eats dry. And then the next two teams that go up after that, you see tableside saucing happening with, I know, Melissa's dish. I believe there were other dishes that this was happening where the sauce is being poured on at the table side. Why could that not have happened with Jamie's jus? Why is that not something that's going on?
I'm wondering if it's because, and Jim's, maybe you know more about that, I think the logistics, but I'm wondering if it's because, like, if you've got the jus in like a serving bowl that's kind of part of the area that's meant to be part of the service versus maybe just wasn't like that for Jamie. But I don't know. Do you know, Jim, how this would be?
A lot of times you need to pick your plates. And so you can't, it's like you can't really run over to the rack and like pour your sauce and some, you know, a gravy boat at the end. you have to sort of specify ahead of time that you want to use a gravy boat to sauce tableside. Most of the time. Now it's possible that if Jamie would have realized he was running out of time and there was some sort of an option like that available, they probably wouldn't have said, no, you can't do it. But at that point, you're still out of time anyway, whether you're in some kitchen you're unfamiliar with trying to run over and find some sort of saucing implement.
Maybe that's why Stephanie couldn't get her tortellini in a bowl. Maybe they were out of it. They just used it all for Melissa's soup.
There are no bowls.
Yeah, we see people who are like struggling for space at the fryer or to use an oven. We don't really haven't talked much about people like struggling to have the right flatware or the right, you know, serving dishes. And
Have you covered on that, Jim? Like, is that how many times has that been an issue that you have encountered on Top Chef?
It's not really an issue, but sometimes, like, when you go, especially in the Top Chef kitchen, they may only have like 10 of one type of plate there. And so if you don't get your plates early, you may be stuck with a little bitty square plate or something that's not really the best for your dish. Or, you know, maybe you need something that holds sauce better. But it's usually not a problem, but it could be if you're not careful about it.
That's an interest. I'm sorry. I'm just thinking like that could be an interesting challenge where somehow like, you get the benefit of choosing what sort of and Mike, I kind of look at you as the historian. Has there been a Top Chef competition where the plate is the variable? It sounds familiar.
Yes, there was a I'm pretty sure we had a quick fire in the past couple seasons where it was like you have to choose either the spoon or I think it was the bowl or the plate, and that determined your teams for the elimination challenge. And that was also how you determined the dish was like what utensil will you use to transport it to the judges' mouths.
And with your hand, you had to feed Tom. That's right. Now I'm remembering.
It's just a picture of a baby bird. What does that mean?
Here comes the airplane as you fed him your gremolata.
Yeah, they gave him the baby bird. They're like, I don't understand this. Then they gave them a picture of chattering teeth. Yeah, it's like, oh, okay, I got it. I know what to do. It was a baby bird plus chattering teeth.
Yeah. Am I the only one that was surprised that Jamie went? I actually thought this was going to be Leanne's curtain call here.
Yeah, and that's wild because, you know, just looking at the ingredients, what Leanne made sounds like something I would love to eat. Mm-hmm. I love duck. A garlic sauce is an incredible thing, and combining that with duck sounds wonderful. The celery root puree I'm always here for. Any like savory dish that has an apple component, I'm usually interested in. It's like all the components to Leanne's dish sounded great, and it just like it was a cluster when it came together.
You don't like beets too.
I don't love beets, but I'll eat them. And like I'd certainly would eat them in the context of everything else that's on that plate. But it just like it did not coalesce. And Jim, I think that you brought up something that like I hadn't even really either remembered or realized about Leanne, like having worked with Top Chef in an official capacity before. She's struggling, dude. What's going on? What's going on with Leanne?
She's really struggling. She did so much better on her Last Chance Kitchen comeback than she has this time around. And she's, I don't know, maybe she's just in her head a little bit. And I don't know, this dish to me, although it seems good, it's one of those ones where she needed to seriously edit like two kinds of beet purees, black garlic sauce, roasted apples, there's celery puree, you know, duck confit and breast and egg. And it's just like
a million ingredients.
A million ingredients.
And I think even Malarkey said, like, when you have me looking at your dish and saying there's a lot on the plate, there's a, you might want to edit.
Yeah, I love that's interesting to me that, like, she, you know, we're talking about her, and at least in this podcast, is like maybe somebody who comes into this with like a bit of that like production advantage and like somebody who would like know a thing or two about maybe like what has worked for, you know, the palates of the judges, and is consistently failing. Is she like being graded on a harder rubric? Is that getting in her head? It's just I'm curious because I think certainly I, you know, Leanne was first in my draft board, so I've been expecting a lot more than what we've been getting.
I do think that maybe I'll be real quick. I think that maybe like if you, even though she has that experience, it may be detrimental one way or beneficial the other. But I think that where she gains the most benefit is if she's in the middle. Like a bad dish has nowhere to hide. A good dish will land you on the top. But if she has an iffy, mediocre dish, and then that's probably where that production side of things might benefit her the most.
Mm. Yeah. Especially with this sense. Many people still in the competition.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know, I was looking at that dish. Again, one of the reasons why I felt maybe she would have gone above Jamie is because they at least said that Jamie had the art right, but the cooking was off. And you see that. I think Jamie actually had a very nice plating. That's another reason why I like this challenge, is because it was just like a fun way to view how the plating incorporated into the aesthetic as well. Whereas Leanne admitted it was one of the worst plating she's ever had in her culinary life, to the point where she lists off two beet purees. I did not see a yellow beet puree in there at all. I just saw red, red, red. And so I just thought, like, I thought it was two strikes versus one, but I guess Jamie's butchering of the chicken was something that really won out at the end of the day.
You have to cut Leanne a break. She was trying to put the alpha and the omega on a plate. She was literally plating Jesus, God, the Lord. That is everything. Of course it was going to be difficult to pull that off. You have to give her a little bit of credit for at least trying to do that. No one else was plating Jesus.
I hope that she would have gotten eliminated so she could come back three eliminations later.
Too soon, Mike. Easter's canceled.
Wow.
And we've got a little bit of a preview, again, not jumping fully ahead into Last Chance Kitchen, but we do see that at least there, Jamie seems to be insinuating that one of the reasons he was eliminated was the order of the serving of the dishes. He kind of said that because I served last, my chicken was, you know, not as up to par as it should have been. So the time between, I guess, it being plated and the judges trying it was at least part of why Jamie seemed to think he also went. Tom, of course, in Last Chance Kitchen was not buying it.
Yeah, Jim, talk to me about that, because I'm assuming that's also interesting, too. I know they try to stagger finish times for you all so that things aren't sitting out for too long. But like, if a tasting runs long, are you just like keeping things under a heat lamp and praying?
Well, no, that would probably have been better. I mean, even though his chicken would have still continued to cook under heat lamp, it would have. What happens when you do one of these like group tastings at a table, they may start with one dish and. When you see them taste it, sometimes they edit it where it doesn't look like they just taste one dish at a time, but they usually, they're tasting one dish and they're tasting it and they're talking about it. And if they talk about one dish for 10 minutes, that means that your dish is just sitting on a table and hasn't gotten to. Now, I do think that most of the time they're lenient. They understand that, well, your dish is not going to be hot anymore if it's been sitting on the table for 10 minutes, we haven't touched it. But I don't know that that would necessarily cause Jamie's dish to dry out. I will tell you that that's another, well, that may be another good reason to sauce tableside, because your sauce in a boat is going to stay a lot hotter. I mean, even if you pour it and then it sits for 10 minutes, if there's a lot of sauce on that plate, it's going to help keep that dish warm and wet. Hot and heavy coming through.
Well, I don't know how we're supposed to, you know, how do we follow up warm and wet, you know? That's really Bloom's territory, and he didn't say anything.
Take us back to the old Jesus duck. Can we do that?
Let me proud, Jim. Can I ask another random question? Where the hell is Jen Carroll? This has been super surprising me to have her become the Melissa Michelle of the season, like the most purples contestant, considering just like, I mean, I think she's more well known for her personality. Maybe this means, it seems like maybe next week she's in a bit of trouble, but I was very surprised that like I don't think we saw her quickfire dish. Her elimination dish was like barely mentioned. So like, I'm just very surprised with, I mean, like you said, Antonio, I think it's very tough to dissect the edit of Top Chef. It really is like, if you're having a good or a bad day, you will be featured that episode. It's very Australian Survivor in that perspective, but I'm just surprised as like how Jen has been. I mean, she's made it further than she has her past two appearances, which is a good thing, but we really haven't seen much from her.
Yeah, Melissa, Jen, and Lisa were next to each other at the quickfire tables, and none of them were shown in the quickfire. I think they maybe just lost the reel from what they were filming there, because they just all three just got the chop, and not that is not another show. They just weren't included, which was odd. And then Jen, yeah, in this in the challenge, other than maybe not being able to say neoclassicist, she just made a dish that they felt was just fish and sauce. So really not super inspired. Yeah. It was. Did you feel seen, Josh, when Lisa was talking about how she was inspired by conflict and including prunes because it was important to help you poop? Yeah. Was that a thing? Like,
prunes,
I don't
represent
know.
Conflict in a pretty serious way, in the sense that it's a dried prune, and a deeply dried prune at that, that saves John Ritter's life in Problem Child. When he's when he's shot by Kramer and he gets shot in the prune, so thankfully he survives. And
look, a giraffe.
Yeah,
it was very odd. I just there were some very fun moments in these episodes. Speaking of fun moments, Haley, I would like to ask you about this. Can we talk about Gail's shoulders? She was really serving some shoulders. Did you notice this on her outfit at the dinner?
I did not.
Oh man, Mike, did you notice? Did anyone notice? Am I the only one? I mean,
between that and her coining the term "wafy grape," this is an all-timer episode for Gail. Well,
those shoulders were off the chain. That outfit was incredible.
Was she like in a cold shoulder top? Like just the shoulders cut out, or was it just
all arm? It was a little bit. There was a little bit of shape to it. It was a really cool top. Definitely stood out to me. Maybe I've been watching too much Drag Race, but yeah, jump right off the page.
They are knocking it out of the park with these dining venues. I don't know what it was, but like this particular episode, like my God, I would want to eat there, even if I ate just Jamie's overcooked chicken for four courses. Like just the everything around them was, I don't know if it was in the Getty or if they found another place and just dressed it up to look like a wing of the museum, but it was just so spectacular.
This sounds like the commentary from a man who's learning how to eat with his eyes.
Exactly. Slowly growing those tongue out of my eyes. By the time we finally go outside, I'll be able to take on the world in a whole new way.
That's how you get COVID-19.
Exactly. Put your eye tongues away. Get them away from people.
Yeah, now you need a blindfold in addition to your mask.
That's the bird box.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I would also like to ask just generally, and I'm sure Jim will be on this, maybe Emily, I don't know about anyone else. Does anyone know what charred allium oil is? It was in Melissa's dish, and that is not something I'm familiar with.
Go for it, Jim.
Yeah, the allium is the chive, garlic, onion family, and I'm sure that she just got a good char on them and pureed it in oil and probably strained it really well to get that real pretty thick dark green color.
Yeah, her dish was so beautiful. It was legitimately gorgeous. Like it was a definite winner, just on site eating with eyes alone. And then to have Ludo say it was a Michelin, Michelin dish for wonton, like that's that was pretty high praise. She really crushed it.
Jim, any of the other dishes that either stood out for you for good reasons or for ill?
I will say that Stephanie Seymour's bologna tortellini sounded freaking awesome. Like as soon as she said mortadella tortellini, I was like, oh yes, bologna and pasta. So I was super excited about that. I really do think that this is an all-star season. Everything looks really good. I think it makes it easy to find mistakes when they happen. So many of those dishes, even though Stephanie Seymour was on the bottom of that group, they barely even mentioned, Greg looked heartbroken when he didn't get any, acknowledgement at the end that, his dish wasn't near the top. And so I think that there were, this just is going to be a season of really good food and a season where it's really easy to point out mistakes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. But Jim, I want to ask about that because obviously as a Top Chef historian, I think the I wouldn't say the common knowledge, but the big rumor behind All Stars 1 was that like it was pretty much like Richard Blaze and then a good amount of other fun personalities. Are you getting a sense of any front runners right now just based on either their reputations going in or what we've seen them do so far?
Well, I will tell you that the person who I don't think got the best at it her first time around, but is super amazing. And it's easy to say now for this episode is Melissa. But
yeah.
when when the questionnaire went out to everyone who has ever been on Top Chef, are you interested in All Stars? Who would you recommend? Melissa was my number one pick for that list. And I hope to see her go really far. In fact, Melissa, Gregory, and Stephanie Seymour were all on my, we're all three on my list of like.
You're a Rococo guy. Look at you.
Mm-hmm. I think that you got to say Kevin looks like a front runner right now. I think probably Voltaggio is going to get a lot of love throughout the season, especially the way he's going.
And the way his face is.
I was waiting for Haley to say something.
But yeah, I do think that those people who were on the earlier seasons are in much better shape than the newer folks. Cool. Brian Husky was the other one who was on my list of recommendations. I really wish he had made it back on. Wow, Brian Husky.
I have no memory.
Yeah, I remember him. Yeah, I remember he was
my Swiss cheese Top Chef brain. I don't know.
Yeah,
through the whole. I mean, assume for Kurt as well. Yeah,
googling.
Oh,
hey, do y'all know about Wolfsbane? You know the judge with the crazy hat at that table.
I think it's called
Wolfsbane, right?
Isn't that Wolfsbane from The Simpsons?
No, it's Ranger Wolf Castle.
Wolf Castle.
I wanted to ask about that. I thought there was like in tribute to the Renaissance, they brought some sort of like Renaissance messenger to sit at the table.
I was surprised that Vigo the Carpathian's invitation was lost in the mail.
What should we know about Wolfsbane, Jim? Yeah.
I think that's the right name for the restaurant, but I was first told about his restaurant like 5 or 6 years ago, and that they may have been shooting in his restaurant. The way that the restaurant was described to me is now he is an artist turned chef. Like he's a classically trained art student, then turned chef. And the way his restaurant to me was described as a supper club, which requires a password and a giant, it's like $1,000 plate to get in. And then it's like this weird avant-garde food dining experience, and people, I know it's really hard to get on the list, and I know that that may have been where they were filming. I know they didn't say it, but it was described to me as like maybe sometimes rotating between this arts warehouse and just sort of the super secretive food art.
Sounds awesome.
I once participated in a meal with an artist. It's actually me and Wesley True. I heard y'all give Messy Wesley some love on the first podcast, but
Cochino.
Me and Wesley and this artist were like airbrushing purees on plates, and then the artist had this idea it was sort of a protest for food waste at the same time, and so everything that people didn't eat off their plates, instead of going into the trash, went into this art bucket, and then it was taken outside and put on this giant canvas that had art on it, sort of like a color in play, they would take bones and put it in one section, and then like the different color purees in another section, and then everyone who came to this dinner came outside. And then they looked at all the food waste that was then turned on into art. And then the dude poured lighter fluid all over it and lit it on fire. It was one of the craziest experiences. I'm not even doing it justice how weird this event was. But,
did you know ahead of time that he would light it on fire, or did that come as a shock to you?
I really wasn't exactly sure what was going to happen to it. I know, and they were like, okay, don't throw this away. I was like, okay, this is really kind of gross, but interesting. It was fun to airbrush because the guy's a stencil artist. And so he gave a stencil for each plate. And then we would airbrush purees onto the plate and then plate on top of it and do this really food art installation. I know that's a little bit off topic for the story, but seeing this, talking about Wolfsbane in the museum, I kind of have this memory of this strange art event that I went to.
Yeah, I'm looking at pictures of Wolfsbane right now. It's like if you were dining in like an I Spy book. It's so eclectic.
What's with you and the eyes today?
Yeah, I was going to say, there you are again with eyes and eating.
And I taste with my eyes.
We know! The tongue!
Stop trying to make this eyes. A thing!
Like I Wolverine.
Yeah, that's my new horror movie, The Eyes Have Tongues.
Ew. Oh. I'm upset.
That was pretty damn cool.
Mike, this is the last podcast you're allowed to be on.
Oh my God.
Well, I'm going out on top for me.
Listen, if Fox is saying it, I have to support her choice, but we'll always have lost. can somebody who watched Last Chance Kitchen tell us what happened?
I think, yeah, I can do that. So you had Jamie going up against Joe Sasto, and they were in Last Chance Kitchen. I had hoped again that they were going to maybe be doing all of these Last Chance Kitchen competitions in various restaurants around LA, being driven around in a BMW, but no. So it was a game of chicken where they had Joe and Jamie had to cook chicken. But they kind of turned it into a strange reverse auction where they asked, like, Joe, how much time do you need? And he's like, 25. And then, well, Jamie, you guys could probably do it quicker, couldn't you? He was, okay, 24. Joe, could you go faster? 23. And so they bid back and forth to get the time to a specific level. And then they did the same thing for ingredients. And so it's like, oh, I could do 10 ingredients. Joe, that seems, you could go lower than that, couldn't you? Yeah, we can do 9. We can do 8. So they end up having to develop each a chicken dish in 20 minutes using no more than 7 ingredients, including the chicken, including salt. The strange thing was, and I had this in my notes, and Brian Edwards pointed this out on Twitter. It's like, I hope someone can explain what incentive the contestants had by going lower with the prep time and ingredients. Why not just agree to the higher numbers? And I have to say to Brian, no, nobody can explain this, because there was no incentive given for them to not just say, you know what, 90 minutes. And then for the other contestant to go, you know what? Cool. And what about 12 ingredients? You know what? Sure. So other than Tom,
Jim, can you speak to like the Top Chef security team that's in place that is forcing you on pain of death to really participate?
I was going to say, you
goofy hijinks.
Well, you know that if they did that, Tom Colicchio cuts the camera, choose them out for about 10 minutes about how you have to do this challenge, and they're like, okay, let's re-roll it and pretend like we never had this moment happen.
Yeah, and you know, I may have talked about this before too, but once you get the what the challenge is going to be from Tom, all the cameras shut off, and then legal comes in and you have to sign stuff that says, oh, we understand the rules, we won't complain, I understand that somebody's going to get eliminated, I'm not going to say I didn't understand the rules. So that you have to sign a, for each challenge, you have to sign another disclosure form and agreement saying that you understand the rules. And then I'm sure that they're like, okay, you have to make this interesting. You have to bid each other down. Because you're right. It would have been interesting if they would have given the whoever chose the shortest time and the least ingredients some kind of advantage. Maybe even if it was an unknown advantage, that would have made they've given them more incentive to bid each other down.
Agreed. There could have been game elements that they could have put into this to at least make it make more sense. So like, if you have the winning, if you bid 20 minutes and you're currently the winning bid, then you also get X. And so that gives the other person incentive to say, no, we can do this in 19 minutes because I want X. I don't want you to have X. So there's game elements that you could have infused into this to have it make a little bit more sense. But otherwise, it just seemed as edited and as shown a little bit off. Also, like, side note, when they were showing, when Jamie was talking through his final dish to Tom, they actually showed Joe's dish on the screen. And then as I was taking my notes, I was like, wait a minute, this dish has leeks. That wasn't one of, did they both do leeks? I don't remember Jamie.
Yeah, I saw the same thing, because Tom was like, Joe, talk to me about the chicken thighs. And I'm like, wait, it says Jamie cooked the chicken thighs. So for some reason, the editing team just completely mixed the two up. That would have been an interesting thing if they pulled like a Steve Harvey and Tom was like, I made a mistake. I'm so sorry. It was not that dish.
We did get Tom's chicken impression, which would fit right into the rest of development. So I was pleased with that. Tom clucking like a chicken was not on my Last Chance Kitchen bucket list. But I'm glad we got it. Yeah, I'm glad that happened.
That makes me upset for the chicken people in my life.
It is especially good, though, that we got that, considering we did not get another episode of What Would Tom Do this week. I think we now know the answer to What Would Tom Do, and the answer is nothing.
Wow. He would host Last Chance Kitchen.
Were those not pre-taped? Is that what's happening? Or is it hard for him to say, well, I didn't walk through the Getty,
I didn't walk through the museum, so I don't know. I did my interview with Tom Colicchio,
3 weeks ago now?
2-3 weeks ago at this point. Yeah. Like, Top Chef was about to premiere, and he was talking about it very excitedly.
I thought so.
As if like, and like, he was talking about it as if there were like challenges that were filmed that were in the can already. I can imagine the scenario where it could be a post-production issue potentially. That is something that is plaguing the industry right now. With like, where's the equipment? How many people are allowed in edit phase, if anybody at all? Is that deemed essential work? in California.
Color correction, what have you. Exactly.
So there's those are very valid issues. And if they are looking at how many resources do we have to spend on Top Chef, what would Tom do? Maybe an easy cut.
I predict that when somebody re-enters the competition initially and there's nobody in Last Chance Kitchen for a week, we're going to get a What Would Tom Do episode that week. That's my prediction.
That makes sense.
So Joe ends up winning. He made liver and chicken thighs with leeks, thyme, and lemon. Throw in some salt, water, and butter, and you've got all the ingredients right there. Although, actually, it was chicken liver. That was one of the questions I had. Like, is he doing chicken and liver as two ingredients, or is it chicken liver? And like they clarify. So yeah, Joe's ingredients were salt, chicken, leeks, thyme, water, lemon, and butter. Jamie's were tomato, jalapeno, lemon, garlic, olive oil, salt. And then Tom had to remind him, oh yes, and chicken. He thought for a moment there that he actually had room for an extra ingredient. He wishes he had planned better for having butter in his sauce. And ironically, it was the saucing, a little bit of a nod to the jus Tom, I think, put Joe over the edge for Tom on top. He said the sauce that Joe did really quickly was really smart, and that Jamie's got a little muddy. It was kind of somewhere between raw and cooked. But yeah, otherwise it wasn't a lot of commentary from Tom on like why Joe won, other than it was a really great sauce.
See, it was weird that water was an ingredient. Like I could understand salt. I feel like an element should not be considered an ingredient.
Air. Dirt in there, you shouldn't have to count it. I agree.
The pan.
I'm here for a Captain Planet. Quickfire sounds fun.
Is love an ingredient, Josh?
Yeah. How much?
Heart? Obviously,
heart has to be the protein.
Well, yeah, yeah. They did a quickfire that was that Jim participated in, I think, with the Zodiac. So I think that they had the earth, air, wind, and fire stuff. So they just needed some heart, which they had through Jim Smith. He was the Mati all along.
Wow. That Zodiac fire was the one that got me.
Jim,
so
if Captain Planet was real, you would definitely be getting a ring. I feel that very strongly in my heart. I think that you'd be picked as a Planeteer.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Why would Jamie ever pick boneless chicken? I mean, skinless, boneless chicken breast. His satay was the same problem in Charleston. Like, why would you pick the show that you can cook chicken? Why would you pick the least flavorful, especially when you take the skin off of it? Yeah.
He immediately then just removed the skin and threw it in the fryer.
And Tom was like, interesting choice.
Yeah, that's offensive.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting, right? Because this had been lampshaded. We even talked about this in our preview, right? That Jamie was known for doing a clean sweep at LCK in your season, Jim. So I thought, and I think maybe I don't want to go too tinfoil hat here, but maybe one of the reasons why he was eliminated is because they thought like, well, we'll send him to LCK and he'll have an interesting streak. But I felt like this was just a bad day for a guy that ordinarily would do super well with this type of thing.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kurt.
I was going to say, and like specifically Tom's comment was, well, that's not the first choice of chefs around the world, but go ahead, which I thought was extra salt from Tom.
Totally.
Yeah, that's an ingredient.
That's an ingredient.
Does anybody else have anything else on the episode?
I am so excited for next week only because Brian Malarkey has a giant newsboy cap on for the drama of the episode. And it's the stupidest choice ever. And I'm so excited to take a look at it.
I have a question. Do you think he like looked at his bags when he was packing and he's like, how many hats can one fit?
Have you ever been in a production of Newsies?
I wish. Oh,
I feel like that's a very Mike Bloom.
Yeah, Mike, are you aware of Santa Fe? Are you there?
Are you there?
Not yet. I just get my crutches first before I head off to Santa Fe.
Needs a few more dollars, then he's out of here to stay.
Oh boy,
dreams come true.
Josh, Selfie papes.
We're talking to the king and queen of New York, and Josh and Emily Fox.
Come on, you know the rest.
This might get us a copyright strike, so we have to be careful.
Yeah,
strike.
I thought it's fine if you're humming it.
If it's a parody, you're okay too.
Yeah,
That's Brooklyn's here.
Jim's, when are you submitting a wand off to the Wiggle Room?
I have got to tell you, I am a terrible singer.
Have you heard of Shut Up Tim? He has been legendary.
You could be Shut Up Jim's.
It did.
Oh God.
Look, I do have to say that I know that this may be your last run around on the wand off, but it brings so much joy to my empty kitchen every week to catch the, you know, the wiggle room and the wand off. And, it's always on my must. There's so much RHAP that I have been loving lately. I've got to say, Mike, the Picard has been so awesome. And y'all's podcast has been really great.
Oh, thank you.
I've been stockpiling all of my Westworld, so I'm going to probably marathon that down the road a little bit. I have the three on my DVR so far, but Survivor has been so great. You know, y'all give Rob a big hug for me. I still listen to y'all all the time, even though I'm behind in my viewing. But Tracy, when she comes in the kitchen, sometimes it's like, why are these people yelling in your kitchen on the?
I say the same thing.
She came in the other day when the wand off started, and I had to pause immediately. I know she's just not going to get this.
All right, well, how about this? Here's my handshake promise to you. The wand off will stay active until you submit a wand off.
That's the last one. Yeah.
So that's the last one. So if you hold out, then the wand off has to keep going.
I was so disappointed that the Wombat's hat sold out so quickly. I wasn't able to order in time.
Oh, it's such a shame that you don't know somebody who can send you a Wombat.
Who's not wearing one right now.
It's such a shame that I can't send you. I can absolutely send you a Wombat. Very doable.
Oh, I appreciate it. As soon as I heard y'all and Rod talking about the charity for Australia, I was like, okay, I've got to order it quickly. And then I just got busy in the kitchen. And then the next time I came on, I forgot about it.
No, they sold out quick. And we just did the tallying on all of that. We're really psyched about what we raised. So thinking about like what's the next wave of that we can do, especially now, given everything that's going on. And my like big paranoid concern is just like, I don't want to ship COVID-19 to people. So I'm just trying to like, I want to like really vet that, you know, I want to make sure that everything is as up far as possible, but definitely want to do something else.
Include shipping and handling and your hospital bill. But
I just want to be careful with things coming out of New York. But no, this was fabulous, Jim. We're thrilled to have you here. This is such a delight for me to get to spend my Saturday morning talking to you.
Yeah. Oh, hey, look, I've got to say too, that I know that this isn't a Survivor podcast, but over the years, I'm not sure if I mentioned this on the last time. First of all, I still, whenever I think about you and Rourke talking about me, on location, it always makes me smile.
We had a great time.
Some of those other survivors, they may realize that I'm liking their tweets and have reached out to me before. You know, Christian Hubicki has sent me something. Like, nothing makes my day better than when, like, I see that Christian Hubicki is like something on social media of mine.
Oh my gosh. The idea of the two of you being friends warms my heart.
A Jim's in Christian podcast.
It's like the purest thing in the whole world.
That's all I need in the world right now is Jim and Christian talking about literally anything.
Oh yeah, God. I'd be so here for it.
Robots who can cook. Let's do this.
This is arrangeable, by the way. This is definitely arrangeable. We can make that happen.
Anyway, I didn't mean to cut you off, Jim.
No, I just want to say, look, I know that everyone's in their home. Everyone's locked up. The people who are out there still working, even I'm working by myself. Really, everything that y'all do and the RHAP network does means so much to me. And I know that there's probably thousands of other rap listeners out there who enjoy hearing y'all as much as I do every day. And it really means a lot. And, you know, in the times as bad as they are, at least we can marathon some bad television and listen to awesome folks like y'all talk about it.
Cool. Unappreciated, Jim. I guess we can't close out without talking about like what we've made in our kitchens this week, right? This is what we're doing these days. Mm-hmm. And we made a roast chicken. There was skin, so it was good. We didn't throw the skin away.
The kitten stole a piece of it.
Oh, actually, that is true. Lola viciously ripped the skin off of the chicken you were eating and like absconded with it.
Yeah. That was really upsetting.
It was wild. That was a
Jasper
wild sight.
Started hopping up on the counter and licking our butter.
Uh-oh. That sucks.
It's just seasoning. Yeah.
And Asher has started to feed our dog. And that's like it's a real slippery slope because we've been really trying to avoid that. But like now he's outright holding out things to her and laughing as he does it as if to mock us. So it's too cute to not curb, though, you know?
Communal spirit.
I've given up on successfully making an egg sandwich. It gets too messy to actually contain on a sandwich. So instead, I converted it into a egg burrito with cheddar, and I had chicken and kale sausage, which has not been impacting me negatively.
I was going to ask about that.
But I know. I think I shared with you guys a picture of the baked brie that I had bought online, which was amazing.
Yeah.
And then last night I did go to the Koji burrito truck behind my building, and I had their short rib burrito and the
eggs and potato in it. Is that right?
No. It was like a regular burrito.
Oh, really?
Breakfast burrito.
Oh, I guess I got the breakfast burrito.
Yeah, two burritos.
Awesome.
You know, the Roy Choi short rib burrito was amazing. I tend to go spicy pork, so I also got a couple spicy pork tacos. I actually liked that more so. I think next Friday, because I think it's there every Friday, I'm probably going to get the spicy pork burrito. I'm going to upgrade the size of that thing.
Oh, man. Uncle Tonio, what do you got going on?
Made some fried rice last night, believe it or not.
Whoa! In there
didn't jazz it up too much, but it's the thing is, I for whatever reason that is warped deep in my psyche and would probably take years of therapy to undo, I still follow the Catholic Lenten tradition of no meat on Fridays, so it's a little bit difficult in this time of panic and quarantine to get fresh ingredients that I might otherwise use other than meat, other proteins, things like that. So it was just a pretty basic fried rice, but I went to great lengths to make sure that it was kicked up a little bit. So that was last night. I just continue, though, to be amazed at the pictures on Emily's Instagram and in her stories of what you guys are doing up there. The pizza again this week, blowing my mind. Just great stuff.
At Emily on Instagram. Got to check out her stuff. She's got great stuff.
Yeah. I made a good carrot ginger soup yesterday.
A great friend of the podcast, who I won't name by name in case he wants to remain unnamed, hooked us up with some fresh produce recently. And we have
an abundance of carrots.
If there are no more carrots in the world, it's because we have them. We're hoarding the carrots right now. And
the beets,
carrots.
I may need to send you some inquiries offline because Angela, my wife, came back from her parents yesterday, and they own a winery / restaurant.
Yeah, we're pretty sure we drove past it.
Really?
I pointed it out, and Josh was like, "Huh?" Yeah. And I was like, "Oh my god, come on!"
But
what's the name of the winery? And they're also doing
Palaya Vineyard,
free local shipping. I think.
Yeah, they're shipping out wine bottles. They're doing curbside stuff, so be sure to check it out because we all need to drink during these hard times. But so they have a kitchen that's closed, and so she came back with, I'm gonna say, no less than 10 bags of pasta. So we're gonna have to come up with a lot of pasta ideas, but I've found out recently that my new obsession is bibimbap, which I never had before. It comes in a lot of the meal kits that we do. And I don't know, it just has all these great things mixed in. Last time we had one with mushrooms, which might be my favorite ingredient besides water, if we're counting one. So
water one, mushroom two.
Exactly.
There's earth, right?
So really, you need with your eyes.
Fire, wind, and heart.
Yeah. Nini's got the wind taken care of.
Yeah.
Don't want anywhere near Nini's wind. But.
Oh, man. Cool. And Kurt's drinking water, as I can see. Jim, what's on the menu tonight?
We're doing old-fashioned shrimp boils tonight. You get a biscuit service. You get one biscuit with some smoked salt and some dark cane syrup, whipped butter. You get a shrimp boil.
Yeah.
You get a spinach salad with some lardon, a soft poached egg, and a sherry Benicia vinaigrette. And chocolate chip cookies for dessert.
Oh,
you can acquire all of that just by calling the restaurant and ordering. I'll walk it out to the curb myself. And so
I don't think my friends in Mobile listen to this, but this is no pressure on them. But I actually messaged them right at the top of the podcast when you were talking about your restaurant, letting them know that they should reach out to you. So I will get the few people I know in Mobile, I'm going to try to drive there.
Yeah, and if any listener hears this and is in the area, I will buy a gift card for the first person who DMs me at AC Mazzaro.
Ooh. I'll do it. Yeah,
myself anyway, but I will buy one for any listener or first listener who DMs me. I'll hook you up.
My DMs on Twitter are closed, but they are wide open on Instagram. So if you slide in on Instagram, I will do the same thing. I'm thrilled to throw in behind that at Round Howard. If you can make good use of a gift certificate to Jim, what's the restaurant name again?
The Hummingbird Way.
The Hummingbird Way. So if you can make use of that, slide into my DMs as well. That's a great idea, Antonio.
third me for that. Although we are going to compare notes so that nobody, you can't get three. One person cannot get three gift certificates.
Yeah. And don't come back with a mustache and ask him for it. We can see through that. Yeah.
If someone does shave their head and wants to come back, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I think like the dedication is and impressive, and I'm here for it too.
And please live in Mobile.
Yeah. Or not. I mean, like, you're still, you know, giving a gift certificate.
That's true. That's true.
So, like, really, if you want to do it, just get it done. Cool.
And where, Jims, can people find you on the internet?
Oh, yeah. I'm really easy to find on social media. It's really pretty much all at Chef Jim Smith. And the restaurant is at The Hummingbird Way on all sorts of social media platforms. Yeah, follow, friend, like, DM me, whatever you want to do. I'm a pretty quick responder on the social media, even though I'm not a prolific poster.
Kurt, where can people find you?
Right now, just in my apartment, not really leaving.
What's your address if people want to come socially distant visit you?
I am. My address is at Kurt Clark with two C's on all of your media.
You're going to give it your actual address.
Definitely thought the same.
Well, no, people. It's you know, spoiler alert. Like, lots of my Instagram posts are tagged with my apartment complex and address. So it's. But you know what? Which of the 500 doors am I? but yeah.
We
otherwise,
find out later that your stalker knocked on every single.
They
wall.
Also want to be very careful. Luckily, they may not be able to escape the room if they find you.
That's good.
Luckily, that's the front door behind me, and so we can all see if somebody sneaks in while we're podcasting.
Wow, what a horrifying image! I feel so much more anxious than I did.
Yeah. No, it's like that Unfriended movie that all takes place over Skype, except now it takes place on a podcast.
Oh yeah. God, we're gonna see like 17 sequels to that during the isolation period. Who didn't we hit?
Mike Bloom, what are you up to these days?
At a Mike Bloom type, I did like 10 hours of podcasts this week. People are tired of hearing my voice, so thanks for sticking around in spite of it. But I was also on the RHAP sequester. It's almost impossible to replay, but you could get crib notes from people as to how it went. It was really fun. I can't wait for whatever other... I almost said malarkey, but I know I can't use that term on this podcast because of how it's slanged. What other shenanigans are going to ensue over the next few weeks?
We will find out.
Antonio?
At AC Mazzaro. Yeah, like I said, DM me if you want a gift card to the Hummingbird Way. I'm down for that.
Can I just DM you about like anything in particular?
You, Haley, have free
me reign. Personally.
Yes.
Okay, yep. Perfect.
Yep. Everyone on
Josh, Josh, what's that?
Hey, Haley. Haley, how are you?
Do we want to get into that?
Well, do you want to do like a bonus strong feelings right now? Oh, and we may have some strong feelings.
I'm gonna cry on the podcast.
Yeah, that we need to come up with a new name.
Because somebody was like, yeah, like, why are you guys talking about a podcast about women in the workforce? We're like, I know.
It's like, wait, what are you talking about? Yeah, so we need to we need a strong rebranding effort. At Round Howard, lots going on post-show recaps. Mike and I are talking about Lost on the Down the Hatch podcast. Joe Garfine and I are talking about Westworld on the Westworld podcast. Jessica Lise and I, in a few hours, are going to be pre-recording our Walking Dead coverage of the Four Now season 10 finale. She and I are also going to be podcasting about Killing Eve. Once Killing Eve starts up pretty soon. So if you like Killing Eve, that's a new one that we're going to be doing. Maybe a guest appearance by this woman who is in this room with me.
Me.
Who is catching up on Killing Eve right now as well. Antonio and I are doing Better Call Saul. Bit delayed on this most recent episode. Totally my fault. 1,000,000% my fault. We will figure that out, whether we have to combine that with the next episode or not. Uncle Tony and I will come up with a plan. But just a ton happening. The new superhero podcast we're doing with Kevin Mahadeo.
And you wonder why you have a sore throat. He keeps being like, oh man, I think I got it this time. And
I know.
Like, no, it's your podcasting.
I'm talking a lot right now. Yeah. So it's a lot, but it's fun stuff. And hopefully, if any of those shows are getting you, through with any distraction right now, I feel good about it. So, just a lot going on. So definitely check out post show recaps if you have not done so already. And the wand off, which I guess is going to be here forever until Chef Jim submits a wand off. I'll update the people on the Wiggle Room on Monday when we record it this week. I'm sure everyone will be very excited to hear this news. And they will be petitioning you, Jim, to never sing.
That's good.
So we'll see how that goes.
Oh, my God.
Emily, what do you got going on?
at Emilet on Instagram and Twitter, like an omelet, but with an E. And I am just cooking. I'm cooking every day. I'm just feeding us and making sure
we're having a good time.
Thank you. Yeah.
People should hit up Emily if they've got like stuff in their pantry and you're like, what should I make with this stuff? Because one of Emily's like mutant abilities is like she looks at a pantry and just knows immediately what to cook. I've never seen anything like
challenge accepted.
You talk about it like it's like the easiest thing in the world. I'm like, how did you do this? Well, and it's really alchemy.
We always have like a really funny discussion about how my parents are hyper competent people, and so I grew up in that atmosphere, and therefore had to be hyper competent myself. But Josh,
as somebody who is like the opposite of that, it's like a magic show every time.
Yeah. So my mom's always like, "Yeah, I just threw this thing together, and this is what I do." And I'm like, "Yeah, that's what I do too." And we both like always think that that's a normal
thing. And every other passerby is like, "What the fuck?" Yeah. Like, it's just like, "What are you guys doing?" So you've got cooking questions.
Yeah.
Fox has the hookup for sure.
I got the time.
Cheetos, baked beans, and grape nuts.
Right.
Cheese puffs, Kurt. Hot cheese puffs.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @strong_. You can check out my blog, strongtakes.ca. I was actually inspired by this podcast to start making posts about what I've been making lately.
Amazing.
So I'm going to put one of those up today. And by the time this podcast is up, you can go there and see it. Until next time. Sorry, Michael.
I was going to say, I just realized Top Chef theme plugs. Josh talked about his interview, putting out the window. That's where he is. Randall Park interview on THR. I'm going to be talking with Jamie at some point for parade.com. I'm sure he has a lot of interesting thoughts. So yeah, some Top Chef writing that you can chew on as well until we get into Brian Mulcahy's giant hat and whatever the hell's coming next week.
Yeah, you can just print it out and chew on it. I don't know how tasty that would be.
I thought that was your exit from the show. Just print it out and chew on it. See you next week.
Not quite, but close enough. So you guys can pack your knives and go now, I guess. That's how that works.
That's
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.